Sir Herbert Thompson, too. These advanced aircraft were like the triplane, the Camel, were in the future for you when you joined the Royal Naval Air Service. What influenced you in joining the particular service?
It simply was when the war broke out, every schoolboy wanted to join. And I don't think I was mature enough, and I certainly couldn't have foxed any recruiting sergeant, to join 16. And then I said I'd like to join the Navy, and an enormous amount of influence was brought to me. I thought I'd go to the public school entry, and a lot of influence brought to me by my high master, who said, no, you don't really want to, and you don't want to have that as a career for the rest of your life, I'm quite sure. And I said, eventually I told my father, partly his relief, that I wouldn't do that, but I would join the Royal Naval Air Service, which is a way of getting to the Navy. I was very fond of the sea anyway, and sailing and so on. And I did, and my father, bless him, said, well, if you're going to do it, we'll do it really properly. And when I was a young boy of 10, I'd been introduced to Winston Churchill. It's a long story, but suffice it to say that he said to my father, are you going to let me have him for the Navy? And so when I did enter, my father wrote to Winston and said, he was then, by the way, the Liberal First Lord of the Admiralty. My father had worked for him when he was a candidate in Manchester. And I got a letter from Winston, and surprisingly enough, I got in. And I was still really more interested, I think, in the Navy than the flying, but I soon got bitten with the idea of flying. It was so romantic for a boy. And I longed to go to Cranwell. I'd heard about Cranwell. And instead I was posted to Redcar, a bleak, horribly bleak place then. And I remember being told by one of the old aviators, C.G. Turner, that was a bad place to learn to fly because they instructed on codrons, and he didn't think codron was a good thing to learn to fly on because it taught you to be ham-handed. And he was right, because it didn't have wing flaps, it didn't have a hinged elevator. You warped the whole plane, you warped the elevator. It apparently started out looking like a pusher, but it had a tractor screw, and then a great gap. It didn't have a fuselage, and then a tail assembly, and you sat in a kind of canoe in the middle of it. And it had, whether it's for that reason or what, I don't know, it had the gliding angle of a brick, and you landed. It hadn't got a proper undercarriage, it had wheels in front and longerons which trailed on the ground, and a gnome engine, which of course had no throttle, and only the usual two speeds of a gnome, stop and go. But unfortunately, I had an instructor who was really rather frightened of instructing, and he took longer to teach his group than another chap, so I lost my friends who'd come up from Crystal Palace. And it was a fortnight late in joining them at Cranwell. And then things really started, because the first flight you went on was a Curtiss. And that had a very reliable engine and would have a throttle. So very much nicer, therefore, than a gnome. It had one thing designed, I think, for future use on seaplanes, because instead of a joystick, you had a wheel. It was a bit sluggish, but anyway, reliable. And I was very lucky. I didn't have to stay long on that one. Got a certain amount of experience, and I went on to an Avro, which is the famous Avro 504, which is a lovely thing to fly. The only trouble was it had the gnome engine, which I think must have been about the most unreliable engine you would ever think of. And it had a genuine danger that if the spring of the inlet valve, which balanced the inlet valve at the head of the piston, if that broke, then centrifugal force would keep the inlet valve open, and instead of closing on the firing stroke. The firing stroke would go down into the crankcase in the middle and might ignite it. And while I was at Crown Royal, one of the aero instructors was killed that way, coming in. Then I went on to a...
May I ask, if it caught fire, did it stream, the flame stream
it came,
back?
It came straight back, because the only thing that anchored the anchored the engine to the aeroplane at all was a hollow crankshaft, and that was bolted onto the aeroplane and emerged exactly between your knees. It never happened to me, but I've had a missing a cylinder missing, and the only thing I had to do was to switch off and come down. I was extraordinarily lucky, but it was always a fear at the back of your mind, and I suppose the B2C was, I found, extraordinarily stable, and I was extremely fortunate. One of the instructors had met a cousin of mine at Redcar, and she'd written to him and said that he must look after me, and he did. And he pushed me through in order to make up time. And I think I was only on D flights with that about 5 days. And then he went on to the scout flight. And the first thing one flew was the Bristol Bullet, as they called it. And of course, you couldn't be instructed in that. You just got into it and went off. And it also was celebrated, no. But the next thing I flew on that was 1.5 strutter. Sopwith, immediately after that, I changed my mind and said, I'm not going on seaplanes. I am going out to France and fly Sopwith. The flight commander was a man called Donald, who rose to the giddy height of an air marshal in the Second War, delightful chap. And I said, can I do that? And he said, well, if you want to break your bloody neck, I won't stop you. So I was allotted to scout. And you were supposed to train. We went off to a place called Freeston, which was quite near, and you were supposed to learn gunnery, aerial gunnery, but for some reason or other, I only flew about twice there, and I was only there for about 4 days. And down I went to Dover.
May I ask, during the aerial gunnery school, did you shoot at towed targets, drogues, or on...
No, it was the target was held up by a balloon. And one day, a lucky shot of somebody hit the wire of the balloon. So we didn't fly that day anymore. It was really Heath Robinson, sort of. Nobody knew what to do with it at all. I mean, we did a bit more gunnery, and you learned all the stops on a Lewis gun. We found a Lewis gun on that thing for some reason. I can't remember why. And of course, the last thing you'd ever do was execute repairs to your gun in the air. If you were a single seater, and of course, none of the things the only Lewis gun I ever flew in a fighter was in number 11 squadron, when we had the range of Nieuports. Was the baby Nieuport, the ordinary Nieuport, and a converted two-seater Nieuport, and you had one Lewis gun over the top plane, which of course avoided the propeller. The only thing was changing the drum, because you pull a string like the chain of a WC, and down the thing came. It released the top of it and switched back, and you removed the drum and replaced it. First time I removed the drum, it flew out of my hand and dropped somewhere in the middle of Belgium. I don't quite know where. Might have hurt somebody. But you also had a Lewis gun, of course, in a pub, and there were about five of us landed up in Dover at the same time, and we literally changed feet and went off them after about a couple of nights there. And I felt frightfully ill on my when I woke up in the morning, I was supposed to go out on the duty destroyer, and I was all over a rash, and I didn't know what was wrong with me, and the doctor, the surgeon, diagnosed German measles and said, you can't go today. So I recovered from the German measles, and I was left behind, stranded at Dover, and they thought they'd better resuscitate the Dover patrol, as they had a pilot. Nobody ever did anything there, and I think I was kept there for about 6 days, flying the Dover patrol. And to me, it was extremely romantic, because when I decided to join the RNAS, I picked up a book, The Letters of Harold Rocher, who seemed a charming character, and he became a hero of mine. And there I saw on the hangar door some orders signed H. Rocher, and I felt I really was in the Navy by then. And of course you were, as I said, I didn't go flying seaplanes, and I'm very glad I didn't, because it was flying a seaplane was rather like driving a London bus, I imagine. I've only been up in 1 month in that war. And there's only some gesture to fly the Dover patrol. It flew up and down the channel looking for, I'm not quite sure what, but it didn't come out. You merely saw our shipping and no Germans or anything else, and no German aeroplanes came over. And Bristol Bullet, I never got one up higher than about 6,000 or 7,000 feet. It wouldn't have been the slightest use to anybody. Then I was suddenly shot out, and I went off to romantically to number 11 squadron, which was supposed to be forming, but it never had a chance of forming properly because casualties in the squadrons lent to the RFC. I think there were about 4 squadrons had been lent by that time. We had to replace them, and it wasn't long before I was suddenly transferred at a moment's notice to the greatest piece of good fortune that ever happened to me in the whole of the RNAS. I went to the celebrated number 8 squadron, which was commanded by the finest CO a young man could ever be under. Astonishing age of 25 he was. I thought he was Methuselah. But he's an awful, he's been a permanent friend of mine ever since. And they then had triplanes.
That was Little.
No, the CO was Bromwich.
Oh, mm-hmm.
Little was a flight commander.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't a flight commander when I arrived in the squadron. He was only a member of B flight. But I can't remember. I think it was a man called Arnold who went home, and then Little was given command of B flight. Cumston was also a celebrated airman. He was the celebrated pilot, and he commanded number 8. He commanded A flight, and Booker commanded C flight. They'd been formed, of course. They were specially formed out of the Navy to help the RFC, because we had these excellent Sopwiths. And they went down to the Somme. They'd come back to refit entirely with triplanes. And then they went down for the Battle of Arras, in time for that one, and I joined them at the height of the Battle of Arras. A strange new boy. They didn't really, considering the strenuousness of the big battle, they didn't have all those casualties. I think they lost about not more than four pilots out of 15, and only all of them weren't killed.
Do you think that was due just to good luck or to rather more expert flying?
Well, I think that expert flying, because we were very lucky. I'd flown, before I went to France, I'd flown the colossal number of something like 23 hours. Whereas the poor old RFC chaps, same age as I was, they'd be jolly lucky if they'd flown 10. And by the accident partly of my the German measles. In that week I put a lot of flying in because there were about five available aeroplanes. There were three Newports and two Bullets at Dover. Anybody who flew regularly out of Dover Aerodrome became a pilot, because the thing was only about the size of a billiard table, and one side it fell into the middle of Dover, the other side, a short interval, it fell into the sea, the other side it fell into the Duke of York's school, and the fourth side it fell into Dover Castle with a sort of enormous I don't know, got a ravine in the middle of it. It wasn't even a rampart. One really had to learn to fly in that place. And coming in one way, of course, one always had to land absolutely accurately into the wind, because if you had drift, off came the wheel, off came the tires. The tires always reminded me, even then, of bicycle tires, and they swept off in a way where, and over you'd go. And one of the approaches, you had to come through a gap between the hangars and the castle in order to get your wheels down at all. I really did learn in that week an awful lot. And then, of course, I was again lucky, because number 11 hadn't formed, and we never did an offensive patrol one of them.